if the legislature wants to keep spending money, it's going to have to find it somewhere, and the earnings reserve account of the permanent fund is the most likely source for that.
A credit rating agency finds reason for a rosier outlook for Alaska's finances. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, December 14th. Good evening, I'm Zachariah Hughes. Also tonight, temperatures in northern Alaska have gotten so high, even monitoring equipment is confused.
What's been happening at Ukiagvik is that temperatures are warming so fast that quality control algorithms finally had enough.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Did you know while exposed to secondhand smoke, every breath you take can damage your heart? Cells lining blood vessels become swollen and inflamed. Plaque builds narrowing blood vessels, and clots can form, robbing the heart of oxygen. Exposure to secondhand smoke increases your heart disease risk by up to 30%. It's your heart protected. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline, 1-800-QUIT-NOW.
Up until 2016, Alaska had the highest credit rating Moody's Investment Service had to offer. Then, after the global price of oil crashed, it took Alaska's budget down with it. And since then, the state's credit rating has taken a nosedive, too. But recently, Moody's has changed their outlook. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Rasha McChesney has more on what's changed.
A few months ago, Alaska's professional number crunchers went out on a mission. Department of Revenue Commissioner Sheldon Fisher says it was an educational one.
We met with all of the credit rating agencies and tried to help them kind of understand what's happening in Alaska, the assets that are available.
And a few weeks later, Moody's updated Alaska's credit rating. In late November, Moody's changed its outlook on Alaska from negative to stable. And what does that mean for Alaska?
It means that we actually spend less. If they were to have downgraded us, it would have cost us more to have borrowed money in the future. So that's a positive.
But what happened? Why did Moody's analysts change their opinions? Oil prices are still pretty low. The state is still spending more money than it makes. And it hasn't gotten an income or sales tax or any other way to bring a bunch of new money in. Dan Seymour is a bond analyst for Moody's, and he's the lead analyst for Alaska. And one of the first things he says is the state's credit rating is still really, really good.
A AA3 rating is an extremely high rating.
In fact, it's the fourth highest rating on their scale.
Which indicates virtually zero risk of default on the bonds by the entity that has borrowed the money. Which is to say that Alaska is rated higher than the vast majority of borrowers.
But most states are. And when you compare Alaska to other states, it has one of the worst credit ratings. Seymour says when energy prices crashed, it hurt a lot of other states like West Virginia and Oklahoma and New Mexico. And each of these states relies pretty heavily on energy-related fees or taxes to fund their budgets.
I don't think any other state compares to Alaska in its lack of economic diversity or its budgetary reliance on revenue from a single industry.
It's not all bad news. Seymour says, yes, Alaska has been spending billions more than the state brings in. But when you factor in the earnings from the permanent fund, that's the money that the fund makes from investments, the budget hole, that gap between what the state spends and what it makes, it disappears. Because while Alaska's struggled to balance its budget, the permanent fund has been going gangbusters.
5 years ago or so, it was more like $40 billion. So because of the continued deposits into the fund and the strong performance of the fund, it's gotten big enough that there's now a clear path to that fund generating enough income for the state to live on.
To be clear, Seymour says it isn't that Moody's just realized that Alaska has this earnings reserve account and then changed its outlook. There have been other signs of progress. In the last couple of years, the state has cut its budget a lot, and oil prices have gone up a bit. Now, spending money from the permanent fund earnings reserve isn't exactly easy. In fact, the legislature has never used money from that account to cover government operations. But there's nothing in state law that says the legislature can't use it. And there's some evidence that it could happen. Last year, both the House and Senate passed bills that would have tapped into those reserves. And that's one of the things Fisher says helped build the state's case to the credit rating agencies.
Is that what you told Moody's, basically, in a nutshell?
We shared with them the assets we had and gave them a sense of the legislative history. Yeah, I think that's a fair characterization. Yeah.
Seymour says there's another issue putting pressure on legislators to use the earnings reserve account. The state has been relying on savings for 3 years to balance its budget, and it's running out of other savings accounts to tap into. The $13.8 billion earnings reserve is the next logical place to go.
If the legislature wants to keep spending money, it's going to have to find it somewhere, and the earnings reserve account of the permanent fund is the most likely source for that.
Spending money from that earnings reserve account is still tapping into savings to balance the budget. And both Seymour and Fisher say there's always the chance that something could go wrong, like the stock market could crash, and the permanent fund accounts could lose a lot of money in a short period of time. But Seymour says Moody's doesn't think the permanent fund's investments are always going to make money. But in the long term, it looks like they will average out to plug the hole in the state's budget. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Rasha McChesney in Juneau.
Three young men have pleaded guilty in Alaska to writing malicious computer software that infected and took control of hundreds of thousands of internet-connected devices, including common household routers. That created a botnet that the men named Mirai. The federal authorities say that was used for what's called a distributed denial of service, or DDoS, attacks. Once the men learned the FBI was onto them, they released the code to other criminals on the internet, and components of it have been seen in subsequent internet security breaches. Assistant U.S. Attorney Adam Alexander says in some cases, the Mirai botnets attacks shut down websites and either slowed or temporarily shut down the upstream internet service providers.
Those were some of the biggest botnet-based DDoS attacks that the internet had seen to date, and resulted in pretty serious disruption and damage both here in the United States and abroad.
In a separate case, two of the conspirators committed click fraud, a scam that makes it appear as if thousands of people are clicking on specific online ads. Since the cost of online advertising is often tied to the number of times people click on the ads, the scheme caused advertisers to pay more than they should have to website owners. Alexander, the federal prosecutor, says the case spanned the U.S. and even reached to other countries, but he says they were prosecuted in Alaska because FBI agents discovered that some of the compromised devices were here in the 49th state. Alexander says the FBI also had local agents who were trained to investigate cybercrime. He says they worked with other FBI agents around the country and investigators in other countries, as well as with outside internet security experts.
It's a combination of traditional investigative methods, you know, shoe leather policing on the part of the FBI agents, in combination with sophisticated and specialized training and experience. It's also critical that law enforcement is able to work hand-in-hand with private partners who may be victims or other significant actors on the internet to be able to identify threats and address them appropriately.
Alexander says that in the interest of safety, it's important to change the default settings on internet-connected devices like routers and to monitor whether there are significant, unexpected increases in the data usage by such devices in a short amount of time, because a drastic increase in usage can be an indicator that a device has been captured by a botnet. Tomorrow is the deadline to apply for health insurance through the Affordable Care Act. Premiums are down this year, and that's in part due to the Alaska Reinsurance Program. The state-run program helps cover the high cost, the high price of care associated with certain health conditions, and has reduced the average cost of an individual health plan in Alaska by 22%. Nearly 20,000 Alaskans signed up for insurance last year. The state's Division of Insurance estimates that fewer than 15,000 Alaskans had enrolled by the end of last week. This year's enrollment period is about 6 weeks shorter than it was in 2016. Division Director Lori Winghire is hoping for a strong showing in the final week. Premier Alaska is the only insurance company offering individual plans in the state. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, how a small Aleutian community is powered almost exclusively by renewable energy.
We were either pretty lucky or pretty smart or a combination of both.
That is ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Going without health insurance could be financially devastating. Healthcare bills are the leading cause of personal bankruptcy. Open enrollment for 2018 plans is November 1st through December 15th. A household of four with an annual income of less than $123,000 may qualify for federal tax credits to help cover premium costs. Get signed up for health insurance at healthcare.gov today. This message sponsored by the Alaska Division of Insurance.
The Kenai wildlife experts say the region is experiencing a resurgence of the spruce bark beetle, an insect with a history of causing tree deaths in south-central Alaska. The Peninsula Clarion reported Tuesday that the region's last outbreak of spruce bark beetles was in the late 1990s. The U.S. Forest Service and Alaska Division of Forestry have run annual aerial surveys of damage caused by the beetle since the 1970s. This year's survey tallied the most damage since 1997. State Forest Health Program Manager Jason Moan says about 95% of that damage was in south-central Alaska. Former Fish and Wildlife Service ecologist Dr. Ed Berg says prior to the 1990s outbreak, the last major spike in the spruce beetle population was the 1880s. North Slope climate change just outran one of our tools to measure it, was the message from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration earlier this month, when an algorithm they use for quality control dismissed the data coming out of Utqiagvik. Ravenna Koenig of Alaska's Energy Desk has more.
NOAA manages thousands of weather stations across the United States that measure temperature and other variables. That data helps weather forecasters, but it's also closely monitored by climate trackers.
And what's been happening at Utqiagvik is that temperatures are warming so fast that quality control algorithms finally had enough and said, oh, the station must have moved because temperatures can't be warming this fast naturally.
That's Rick Toman, NOAA's Weather Service climatologist for Alaska. The algorithm he's talking about is designed to flag data that looks wrong. When scientists see a flag like that, they investigate. And sometimes they find that the weather station has moved, say, closer to or further from the coast, which explains why it's recording such different temperatures. But that's not what happened in Utqiagvik. Temperatures there really are just that much warmer. This November was the hottest on record, averaging 17.2 degrees Fahrenheit. Brian Thomas works in the NOAA Observatory in Utqiagvik and says he can see obvious signs of warming.
When we look out on the ocean right now, we see a few icebergs. Normally we would see white to the horizon, you know, in the past. And in this case, we're seeing dark water to the horizon.
NOAA is working to tweak the algorithm to make it more forgiving in the Arctic, where climate change is happening twice as fast as anywhere else on the globe. They hope to have the adjustments in place in a month or two. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Ravenna Koenig in Fairbanks.
A small eastern Aleutian community is now getting nearly all of its energy from renewable sources. With a second hydro facility that began producing power late this spring, the city of King Cove has dramatically reduced its dependence on diesel, as the Energy Desk's Zoe Sobel reports.
Gary Hennig has been focused on renewable energy ever since his first city council meeting as King Cove City Administrator in 1989.
The council said, hey, you're the new guy, and we're starting to learn something about this hydroelectric potential that we have in the Delta Creek Valley. And can you help us figure out, is it something real? Is it good for the community?
Diesel was relatively cheap back then, but Hennig says the community got fired up when they found out hydro looked like a promising power source for King Cove. In 1994, Delta Creek came online, and pretty soon the community was getting half of its power from renewable energy. But the project was risky. Hennig says Delta Creek cost about $6 million. Grants covered a lot of the cost, but the city still had to borrow a couple million dollars to pay for it. He says back in the early 90s, that was a big deal for a community the size of King Cove, and it paid off.
And within a couple years of Delta Creek getting built, it was easy to look back and say, wow, we were either pretty lucky or pretty smart or a combination of both.
After seeing Delta Creek's success, Hennig says the city started looking into building a second hydro facility. Financing it was a challenge. It took more than a decade to finalize the permitting and round up nearly $7 million. In the end, the city pieced together the funds from a combination of grants, loans, and money from their own budget. Even though it was expensive, Hennig doesn't think residents will bear the burden of paying it off in the form of higher utility rates.
We believe it's quite the contrary, that they're going to end up paying less. And I would hope to be in a position in the next 6 to 12 months to be able to go to the city council with a rate decrease.
Right now, 1 kilowatt hour costs 30 cents in King Cove. It's one of the lowest rates in rural Alaska. Hydropower covers nearly all of the city's 4.5 megawatt demand, which includes 2 boat harbors, public facilities, and all homes. Overall, Hennig says the community is happy with their commitment to green power.
We've come to know that Mother Nature can be our friend and that renewable energy, at least in King Cove, Alaska, gives us confidence about survivability in the future for all things energy related.
But is it possible for other small rural communities to follow in King Cove's footsteps? For the Waterfall Creek project, King Cove got a lot less money than expected from the state. Funding for renewable energy projects has dried up. For the past 2 budget cycles, there have been no grants from the state's Renewable Energy Fund. But Katie Lister of the Alaska Energy Authority says King Cove made it work partly because the city has some financial advantages.
They are small, they are remote, but they do have a sort of an active cash economy in the fishing industry that kind of allows them to access other resources outside of their community that other places might not have the ability to.
Even so, Lister believes other communities can replicate King Cove's energy funding. She says King Cove has proved it's possible to pay for energy projects with more than just grants. Hennig says this is likely the end of bolstering King Cove's hydro facilities, but he's pushing for 100% renewable energy, like another community in Alaska.
We have certainly talked about, couldn't we be even better and be like a mini Kodiak? And that's the new challenge.
With strong winds, Hennig thinks that's what King Cove will look to next. But they plan on taking it slow, with another year of measuring the wind and looking into the economic feasibility of a project. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Zoe Sobel in Unalaska.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Support for public radio comes from the communities we serve. Whether you give as an individual member or through your business, know that your contribution makes possible programming that informs, inspires, and entertains. We thank you for the role you play in your public radio station.
Colder temperatures are here, and the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation reminds you of the danger of carbon monoxide, a poisonous gas that you can't see or smell. If it builds up in your home, it can be deadly. Be safe this winter and have a qualified mechanic ensure your heating system is working properly. Never run your car in the garage or operate a portable generator in an enclosed space. Finally, always ensure your home has a working carbon monoxide detector. This message sponsored by AHFC.
Four Alaska wildfire professionals are working on blazes in Southern California. Alaska Division of Forestry spokesman Tim Mowry says the Alaskans deployed south have special skills.
One is an emergency firefighter who went down as an air operations branch director. Two of them went down as prevention technicians, and one of them went down as a status check-in recorder.
Mowry says most Alaska wildfire fighters take the winter off, but the four in California this month notified agencies they were available to work.
Alaska has not received an order for any crews or modules yet. They did express a little bit of interest, and we're in the process right now of trying to see who's available and how many people we have that are available that we could send down there if they did put an order in. But so far, it's been a pretty limited specialty positions that they've requested.
Mowry says it's the latest that Alaska firefighters have had to go south to work, noting that fire seasons have been extending longer in recent years.
Last year's burst of fires they had in the southeast U.S. where we sent over 100 people down, but that was mid-November, so it's, you know, this time of year, mid-December, it is very unusual. But it is a sign that, you know, what we've been seeing the last few years is that things are changing. And I mean, the fire season is getting longer in Alaska, but it's now almost a year-round deal in California.
The current wildfires in Los Angeles and the Santa Barbara areas follow even more devastating blazes that killed 42 people and destroyed or damaged 14,000 homes in Northern California this October. Starting this summer, larger and fancier cruise ships will begin visiting Alaska ports. The so-called megaships are part of a trend that's sending more and more tourists to Alaska by sea, as Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
If you think Alaska cruise ships are big, you ain't seen nothing yet.
Get ready to glide through your bucket list on our newest and most exciting ship, Norwegian Bliss.
The Bliss, as it's called, makes its first Alaska port call in early June. Week-long cruises will run through September.
Whether you're cruising the Caribbean, the Mexican Riviera, or the wilds of Alaska, there's one way to describe the experiences awaiting you on board.
The ship will sail from Seattle to Skagway and back. It'll be joined by another mega ship the following summer.
Both of them carry over 4,000 passengers. Ovation of the Seas at full capacity can almost go up to 5,000 passengers.
Chris Gray Faust is senior editor of Cruise Critic. It's an analysis and sale website owned by TripAdvisor, a popular travel review app. The Bliss and Ovation will carry up to twice as many passengers as some ships already sailing Alaska waters. But Gray Faust says mega ships already sail elsewhere.
These large ships have been going to the Caribbean for several years. They've been over in Europe, they've been over in Asia and Australia.
So why are they headed our way? John Binkley is president of Cruise Lines International Association's Alaska branch. He says the lines are responding to several years of increased demand.
It's somewhat exotic destination, yet it's on U.S. soil, and it's someplace that people feel comfortable and safe to visit.
That was the case, too, after the terror attacks of the early 2000s. Cruise Critic's Gray Faust says there's also additional interest from overseas.
Ovation of the Seas in particular has been designed for an international passenger base. It's been based in Asia and also Australia, and it already has some name recognition in those regions. And by bringing it to Alaska, I think you'll see more of those international passengers also come up.
The Ovation is leaving its China and Australia routes due to a drop in demand. The Norwegian Bliss is a new ship that adds to the overall number sailing inside passage waters. Binkley says the Ovation of the Seas will replace a smaller ship.
So we are gaining slightly on the number of ships, but most of the capacity increase, the increase in numbers of passengers, is because of larger ships rather than additional ships.
The Bliss will stop in Ketchikan, Juneau, and Skagway. It will also sail to Sawyer Glacier in Tracy Arm Fjord, south of the capital city. The Ovation will be based in Seattle, too. Its Alaska itinerary hasn't been posted yet, but it will likely follow a similar route. I'm Ed Schoenfeld, reporting in Juneau.
In the 1970s and early 80s, people flooded Alaska looking for work in the oil industry. Now, 40 years later, many are still here. Instead of fleeing to warmer weather, Alaskans are aging in Alaska. For the past 7 years, the state has seen the fastest growing senior population in the country. But with age comes a different set of needs. Ann Hillman from Alaska Public Media's Solution Desk has more.
Hi, Gay.
How you doing, Tom?
Good, how are you?
Good.
Tom Russell sits at a lunch table in the Wasilla Senior Center, chuckling about an old hunting memory, when his friends settle in across from him.
If it wasn't for my good friends like these ladies, I wouldn't stick around.
You wouldn't?
Oh.
Russell doesn't mean he would leave Alaska. That's preposterous. He means he would just check out other senior centers in the area. For Russell, Alaska is home. He moved up nearly 40 years ago, and he's here for the long haul.
There's no other place to fish in Alaska, but don't tell anybody that. I don't want him to catch my fish.
As we talk, he pulls out photos of his son and fish they caught together last summer. He spends a lot of time in his boat with family members, though now his son drives instead of him. Russell's slowing down some, but not much. He still lives alone and looks out for himself.
Oh, let's see. I'm 78 right now. Just a youngster.
Like many people in Alaska, Russell is staying in his house as long as he can. And here, that's actually more feasible than elsewhere in the country.
Alaska's like the trendsetter.
That's Elizabeth Ripley, the CEO of Matsu Health Foundation, which focuses partly on healthy aging. She says Alaska has prioritized developing home and community-based services, like in-home healthcare, chore services, and meal programs. It lets people live independently longer.
All the other states wish they were in our spot because more people want to live in, you know, stay in their homes and stay in their communities than live in an institution. And it's usually more cost effective, and it's usually more provides greater quality of life and better outcomes for older adults.
But that doesn't mean older people can get all of their needs met right away. In the Matsu Valley, the population of people who are 65 and older is growing quickly, but funding for services isn't. There's a shortage of primary care providers who take Medicare, transportation options are lacking, waiting lists for housing can range from 6 to 18 months. Similar problems exist statewide. Derek Pennington is the program director for the Aging and Disability Resource Center in Wasilla. He says people who have an emergency are often left in a bind.
So if something happens and you need the service now, it generally is not available.
He says there are no easy solutions for these issues, and organizations need to start collaborating now to fill in the gaps.
We can't get to choose how we're going to pay. Either we can pay for transportation and housing and fighting social isolation, or we're going to all pay with higher Medicaid bills and more assisted living and all these other costs associated with that.
Some of the services that are already in place do seem to be working for those who can access them. Back at the senior center, Russell's friend Gay Scott says aging in Alaska has been easy. Her family helped her when she lived alone, and now she's in senior center housing.
Well, I love my apartment because I'm on the top floor and I've got a beautiful view. People, we must have the best building, and the people on that top floor they're wonderful.
They get together for Bible study sessions and ice cream socials. They can go to the community center to work out and eat lunch. She has a good social circle. No one she knows has considered leaving the state. For Scott,
getting old is fun.
For the Solutions Desk, I'm Ann Hillman.
That is all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we are online at alaskapublic.org. Like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media, and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Rasha McChesney and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Casey Grove, Emily Russell, and Ann Hillman in Anchorage, Zoe Sobel in Unalaska, and Ravenna Koenig and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Zachariah Hughes. Have a great evening.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com.
Now through December 15th is the open enrollment for the health insurance marketplace in Alaska. Plan costs have gone down this year. For free help to enroll, visit getcoveredalaska.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Children's Trust. The Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education offers the Family Education Loan so parents, a spouse, or grandparents can help students with the cost of college or training programs in or outside of Alaska. Interest rates are lower than the Federal Plus, and no credit is required. For more information, call 800-441-2962 or visit acpe.alaska.gov/radio. This message sponsored by the Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education.
Public media loves being part of your day. Thank you for listening and for your support. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.